Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
The Science of Sports podcast with Professor Ross Tucker and sports journalist Mike Finch. Coming up in this episode.
And one of the things that people struggle with the most is that they don't accept their new realities and that exercise is anti-aging. The muscles of an exercising 60-year-old are indistinguishable from those of an exercising 20-something-year-old. And the one tweak you can make is once a week, go to 90. Once a week, go to 80.
Welcome to the Science of Sport podcast. My name is Mike Finch, and as usual, I'm here with Professor Ross Tucker. And as usual can be right now, we are talking to each other via Zoom, which a few months ago I had no idea what Zoom was. I was a Skype person, but now every day I'm on about five different Zoom calls per day, and Zooming is now a thing. So, Ross Tucker, I know that you probably spent a fair amount of your own time on Zoom, and anybody around the world who's involved in business or any kind of personal matters, lots of quiz evenings happening on Zoom as well. It's the new way of communicating. Ross, how has your Zoom week gone so far?
Good, thanks, Mike. Pretty frantic, actually. I can't believe how busy I've been during this time. World Rugby's been trying to monitor certain elements of this disease, so I've been part of a team that's tracking numbers and actions taken by different governments because everyone's thinking about how they can get back to sport. Yeah. So this is actually the busiest I think I've been in easily the last 6 months, if not longer. It's actually been frantically busy. But I am an early adopter to Zoom because this is how we used to work within World Rugby anyways. And I work from home. So schedule-wise, I'm not as put out, but I tell you, I'm tired of this being stuck at home, eh?
I know before we came on the podcast today, you were trying to get yourself a smart trainer because, you know, you can only do so many shuttles up and down your driveway. In South Africa, of course, we have just found out yesterday that we're allowed to go outside between the eight times of 6 and 9 in the morning to do either a cycle or a run or a walk within a 5 kilometer radius. And as soon as I saw that, I went onto an app to find out exactly what my 5 kilometer radius looks like. And we can exercise between those times. But up until now, we've had 5 weeks of people running up and down their driveways, trying to find ways of keeping active inside their houses. And Ross, I know that we talked about this in the last podcast, how important exercise is at this time. And we were interviewed by a local news site yesterday, but the two of us talking about how important it is for just your immunity and your ability to fend off a potential virus being active. So it is quite good news for us South Africans. And for anybody else that is stuck around the world, you know, being active, and we'll keep saying this message, it is important to keep active and healthy during this time.
Yeah, extremely, extremely. I'm so glad they're letting us out tomorrow, even if it is a time constraint. But I can't wait. I can't wait to do that. I tell you, like, in the first week or two, I was pretty keen on using home exercise. And I developed a little circuit, and I was hopping and skipping and lifting weights that had been manufactured out of paint cans into concrete slabs and all this stuff. And after 1 week, all the hopping and the plyometrics, I felt like I had arthritis. I was wrecked.
Yeah.
Which I suppose leads a little bit into this podcast. But then I switched to running some shuttles sort of up and down the driveway just outside my home. And that's a little better, but I reckon I had 3 days of that left before that did me too. So I'm back on the roads tomorrow for sure. Easy runs.
Yeah, so yes, it certainly is a trying time for anybody that is healthy and active. And I assume most of the people that listen to this podcast are some of those people. But as Ross has just alluded to, the subject of today's podcast is not going to be about corona, because we know you're probably a bit sick and tired of listening to all the different doom and gloom stories. And we've decided to focus on something a little bit different. And that is the issue and the discussion around performance in sport and aging. And I'm going to start off the discussion with a man that's quite close to the heart of those of us around the world who are involved in Runner's World magazine. Of course, Ed Whitlock is a very famous person who's been featured in many different editions of Runner's World magazine around the world. Unfortunately, he has passed away. But he was the man who probably made older runners the most famous when he broke a sub 3 hours at the age of 70 and did it again at the age of 74. But Ross, he's very much an outlier, but there are other people that are proving to be just as good, if not better than he was.
Yeah, I saw Ed Whitlock at the time that he did that. I think it was like a 2:54 or something when he was 70 years old, which is nuts. And he holds. There's actually a website. There's a few websites you can go to, and you can find the world record held by people at different ages. And Ed Whitlock starts at the age of 68 with his first one, and then he counts, if I'm counting correctly, 11 world records between then and the time that he was 82. So that's pretty remarkable. One of those was broken last year or 2 years ago by a guy called Gene Dykes, who's an American long distance runner, a marathon runner, at the age of 70, ran 2:54.23. And he was actually tested. So was Whitlock, by the way. These guys who run these incredible marathons at that age are always fascinating to physiologists. So most of them have been put in a lab at some point so that some guy can try and be astonished at the numbers. And I remember reading Whitlock had a VO2 max, which regular listeners will know is like the cardiovascular equivalent of the size of your engine. And Whitlock's was in the 50s, I think it was, in the mid-50s. And Gene Dykes was similarly around 50 in the low 50s. I think his was 49.6, if memory serves me. But one of the things that was really interesting about these guys in those tests was that conventional wisdom is that they, you know, you can normally run a marathon at a certain percentage of your maximum. So if your VO2 max sets the ceiling, then you can run at, say, 80 to 85% as an elite runner. Most of us would run it at like 65 to 75%. Yeah. But these older guys seem to run it at a much higher percentage of VO2 max. And there was some debate about that recently in the context of Dykes and in the context of another guy who ran a crazy fast 2:30, I think it was. Let me just find his name for you. Tommy Hughes ran 2:27.52 at the age of 59. And when he was tested, same thing. He had a VO2 max of 65, which is very good, even for a young elite guy.
Yeah.
But the prediction would be that he's going to run a marathon at something like 91% of that maximum. And there was a whole big debate among scientists about these older runners, like how is it possible? And there's a few reasons for it. But anyway, point is, one of the things that might set them apart is this ability to keep the engine at a very high percentage for a very long time.
So, I mean, I guess the first question that a lot of people ask when they talk about your performance, whether you're a runner or a cyclist or any kind of sport that you do, I guess, is that people expect not to be as good as they get older. Is there what component of getting worse gets worse faster than the other or the others?
Yeah, so aging is one of the few things that every single human in the world has in common. So the unifying force, an undesirable unifying force, which makes it a topic of I think quite a lot of conversation, right? Because everyone wants to avoid it and nobody can. It's a little bit like diet in the respect that everyone then becomes an expert just because we all eat food, whereas most people wouldn't dare challenge a cardiothoracic surgeon on the heart. But the exercise and diet and aging are like that. So unfortunately, like gravity, aging can't be avoided, and we do get worse with age. And we can talk about cardio, and we can talk about strength and power and functional abilities and so on, and the speed at which those things decline as we get older. What seems to be consistent is that, well, two things. Number one is that decrease is gradual at first and then seems to become greater later on. And the second thing is that any activity that relies on power and neuromuscular coordination and speed declines more than something that relies on cardiovascular endurance capacity. So if we set up a spectrum again, and we did this in our podcast on the science of training, where we guided our not-so-fictional friend John to the marathon, on the one extreme, you put the high-intensity, power-based, non-oxidative or anaerobic, if you want to use that outdated term. And on the other side, you put the oxidative endurance, slowed long distance stuff. Aging affects the power spectrum faster than it affects the endurance spectrum, which has some important implications, because of course, we're coming at this from the perspective of sport. But something I've seen, for instance, even with my parents, and you see this with lots of older people, I'm sure you notice the same, is that basic functional tasks that you wouldn't think twice about today become challenging later on because you lose that 10% muscle strength and that 20% coordination. So you're digging in the cupboard because you want to get, a photo album out or a heavy object in the top shelf in the kitchen. And all of a sudden, in that position where you're stretching up, you can no longer support 5 kilograms of mass.
Yeah.
And so those are the kind of implications that obviously would worry society. But then you see that in sport. So sport is actually quite a good way to study and to observe exactly what attributes decline, which then have societal or social impacts for people as they get older.
So, I mean, I've just turned 50 and I regard myself as middle-aged at the moment. And for me, I can tell you that one of the biggest challenges is how difficult it is to get fit. When you're young, you get fit pretty quickly, 2 or 3 weeks, maybe a month, and you can be pretty fit to do pretty much anything. But as you get older, your body struggles to adapt. Is the rate of, when it comes to performance, is it about recovery and the ability to recover at a certain speed that is critical to why we slow down or why we can't be as good as we were when we were young?
Yeah, recovery, I think, is the fundamental thing that separates. I mean, it's not the only thing, but it's probably the one that underpins or, let's say, overrides, covers all the other elements. Is because, remember, when you train, what you're doing is you're putting your body under stress because that stress triggers adaptation. And then through adaptation, you recover, and that looks and feels like fitness or performance. When we are older, both sides of that equation are compromised because, A, we might adapt a little bit less because we're just older. We don't have the necessary hormonal circumstances, things like testosterone and growth hormone to cause the adaptation. But then on the other side of that, the recovery is also compromised. So a training block that looks perfect for a 25-year-old, let's say over a month, is an overtraining block for someone who's 65 years old or even 45 years old because we just don't recover from the intensity work. So you'll remember this, and you've got a son now who's extremely active and doing volumes of training that would make your eyes explode and mine and legs explode. But you used to be like that, right? You could handle, like, jump on the bike and ride for 3 hours. Let's go again the next day. Now that's the session you do every fourth day, because if you didn't, you wouldn't recover. So the whole thing,
like every fourth week.
Well, in some instances, yes. Like I said, I go outside and I do some skipping and some hopping and some box jumps because I'm in lockdown. And literally, that was Saturday. I didn't train until the following day. And that's ridiculous. There was a time when that could have been a warm-up. So aging, depressingly, compromises our ability. And one of the things that people struggle with the most is that they don't accept their new realities, and they in their minds, they're still, flying elite, sub-elite athletes, and their bodies don't agree. So they're asking themselves to do things they just can't handle. So one of the first things about exercising into middle age and then older age is accepting that there are some things you can't do, and you might as well just accept that and then figure out how to optimize the situation.
Well, I mean, we're going to talk about this a bit later on, but let's talk about it now. I mean, the psychological effect of this is obviously quite profound because, as you say, it's suddenly you wake up one day and you realize you weren't what you were when you were 25, even 30. But in your mind, you're still the same person you were back then, and you can't understand why things aren't happening the way they are. I always think the people that are really successful as athletes and sports people as they get older seem to have this continuous mindset that they are as good as they ever were, and that's why they are strong. So psychologically, they just refuse to get old, and sometimes that actually works in their favor. They're just, this lack of acceptance makes them better sports people.
Agree, but it's interesting because there has to be a sort of cognitive dissonance in at some point, right? Because they go about their lives and they don't accept limitations because they're older. So, okay, I'm 50, but that's fine. I'm still going to get on the bike and I'm still going to do the same 2.5 hour, 3 hour, whatever it is, weekend, long ride or run. I'm going to run a marathon in July, whatever.
Yeah.
So that's great. That's what they do well. But at the same time, they've managed to no longer compare themselves to when they were younger, because if they did that, then they would probably either push too hard or they would give up. Because at some point you realize that actually the best days performance-wise are behind you. So what happens on the clock is no longer relevant. And you have to change your purpose. And I think there's probably a lot of people find tremendous relief and happiness in the new purpose they find when they're older, because they no longer are tied to PBs and competition results. Did I come in the top five in my age group? At some point, maybe people say, you know what, actually, this is fun and I'm going to do it for myself for all these other reasons. So on one hand, they live as though they are younger, but on the other hand, they understand the bits that they can't do as though they were younger, and then they get the best of both. And that's what probably makes the successful older athlete today.
So, and ideally, I'm throwing this out as a question and also as a sort of a question from myself, is that we know that when you're younger, you have a chance of being, you're faster, you've got more power, you've got more strength, et cetera, et cetera. If you were going to design the perfect sort of lifestyle or the perfect life as a performance athlete, would it be fair to say that when you're younger, focusing on the shorter distances is where speed and strength are important, is the focus? And then as you get older, potentially the longer distances become more of a focus, which means that potentially you can also create personal bests within those different stages of life. That's one bit of advice I got from somebody who is a very good local runner, who was a very good track athlete up until the age of 25, moved on to the fives and the tens, and then started running comrades, you know, once he got to sort of 40 plus, and has said continually through his life, he's been able to focus on different things and therefore create his own goals that way. Is that a fair strategy to think about if you have a perfect athletic life?
Yeah. Obviously now we're having this conversation independent or distinct from, say, the elite athlete who at the 22, 23 is saying, I've got 5 years on the shelf and I'm going to run marathons for 5 years, because if I do well for 5 years, I'll make $1 million and I'll be good for life. So that's different, right?
Correct.
But yeah, for the rest of us, for whom running is a challenge, an individual task that we do for ourselves to see how much better we can be, something that gives us pleasure, we can be outdoors or social, whatever it is, I think that's fair. That's the scenario for someone who is concerned about times. I mean, how many runners, I suspect, you know, we're biased because we're among them, but I reckon 3 out of 5, if not more, actually aren't running for time anyway. If you look at races around South Africa, half marathons and marathons, obviously people care about their times, but I dare say most of them are really just in it for the other sort of personal reasons and so on. So for them, you know, if they can get 30 years worth of marathon running because they start young, then good for them. But you're right. If you want to use a phased sort of life cycle where you actually then hit distances and events that you're more suited to, then that's what you would do. Yeah.
Because it's not just about aging as well, about the environment that you're in when you're younger, I guess also helps a lot. I mean, these are all sort of environmental factors that affect performance, because as we get older, we get more responsibility. We have jobs and kids and life, and that allows us not to train. People we used to train with potentially aren't able to train, et cetera, et cetera. So I've always wondered, like, yes, we could look at science, but how much does lifestyle factors affect the degeneration of performance? Do we know that?
Yeah, massive. Actually, no, because, and I'll tell you, there's a couple of important conceptual issues that hinder the science on this. One of them is that most of the stuff we know about aging in sport comes from what are called cross-sectional studies. So for instance, if we went and looked at the world records for age, and I'll pull that up here on my computer so that I can give you exact numbers. The world record obviously is 201.39, held by one Eliud Kipchoge, who was officially 33 years old when he did that. If we compare that to, say, the 50-year-old record, and here's a quiz for you. This is a South African man. Any guesses who that would be?
The 50-year-old record. I would say that I should know this as the editor of Runner's World.
I'm sure you'll know the name.
Yeah,
when you get
I do know the name. It just doesn't come to me right now.
Titus.
Who?
Titus someone?
Titus Mamabolo. There we go.
That's the one, yeah. So he holds the world record record for 50-year-olds, 2:19, right? So we've seen there an 18-minute decrease in time or increase in time up to the age of 50. And then by 60, it's 2:36. By 70, it's 2:54. That's our friend Gene Dykes with his amazing running threshold. And then by 80, it's 3:15. And by 90, it's 6.5 hours. So falls off a cliff a little bit. The problem is that's a cross-section because we're comparing a slice at 25 to a slice at 50, a slice at 60, 70, 80, 90. You get it, right?
Yeah.
Ideally, what you would do is you'd follow the same guy for 60 years. And then you would see how he – and then you do that with 300 other people. And you would be able to plot how much slower they got and so on and exactly what happens over time. So much of the research we've got is affected a little bit by that. And the consequence of that is it's very difficult to tease apart what you've just raised, which is lifestyle, from actual physiology. Because one of the realities of life is that when you are in high school and early university and early in your adulthood, in your 20s, you do have more time available. And then you settle down, you get a job, and your boss says to you, work late or start early, and you've got family commitments, and you've got kids, and you've got all sorts of other stresses. And all of a sudden, the 12 hours a week of training you used to do becomes 6 hours a week. And by the time you're 40s, maybe you're lucky to get 2 days a week.
Yeah.
And so then, of course, what's happening is, and this has been documented, your VO2 max is dropping. Your lung function isn't getting worse. Your muscles are weaker. Your body fat's going up and your mass is going up and your muscle mass is coming down. But what's the problem? Is it the fact that you're just not active or is it the fact that you're getting older? And it's actually both because they play off one another. And so with time, we do lose muscle mass. It's called sarcopenia, loss of muscle. Our nerves literally go away. We have fewer nerve axons when we're older than when we're younger. So there are physical things that happen in us with aging that make us less athletic, but they're compounded by the lifestyle that we live. And so the thing that exercise does, and actually I wish we'd started with this early because it's the one thing our listeners can take to the bank, is to say that exercise is anti-aging. Regular exercise is the most effective form of anti-aging. And we can talk about studies where people who are physically active have younger physiologies than people who do not. So if you let yourself go from 20 years old to 80 years old with no training, you are an old 80-year-old. A 20-year-old to an 80-year-old who does regular physical exercise is the equivalent of a 50-year-old who does not exercise. That's the key point.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
That's a significant difference, isn't it? I mean, it's just that's not marginal. It's showing that exercise is a significant role player in aging.
It's enormous. I mean, I can there's diagrams, and you know that these scientists will take scans of people's muscles under electroscopes, and I'll have a look at what they look like at different ages. And I want to find you an actual picture of that just to show you. And then those of you listening, obviously, you won't see this picture. But this video will be up on YouTube at some point, so you can have a look there. Here's three sets of muscles. I think I'll be able to share my screen here on Zoom.
But I love Zoom, eh? Yep. There we go.
There's three sets of muscles. Now, what you guys, if you're listening to this, you can't see is we've basically sliced a person's legs basically in half across. So you can see their muscles from the top as though you're looking at a cross section of their quadriceps muscle. Right. This person on the bottom here is a sedentary 60-year-old. This is someone who's never exercised and is 60 years old. These two on the top belong to a 20-something-year-old and a 60-year-old who exercise. And you can see that the muscles of an exercising 60-year-old are indistinguishable from those of an exercising 20-something-year-old. But if you didn't exercise, it looks like a different thing altogether. It's completely different. So that's the kind of thing that exercise does for you. It defends the loss of muscle mass.
I guess the question is, is that a standard result, or is that Ed Woodlock versus a 25-year-old? I mean, is that a standard? We can take that to the bank and say, if you are a regular exerciser, that is probably going to be the result, which is very confidence boosting for those of us who are regularly active.
So the degree to which that happens is probably influenced by genetic factors. And there are some people who just are, for want of a better word in these times, immune to aging. Okay, so Ed Whitlock, Gene Dykes, Tommy Hughes are probably people, for whatever reason, who just do not age as much or as significantly as others do. And something that's interesting about those guys is most of them are very good runners when they're younger. So Ed Whitlock was a good runner. He was a university-level competitive athlete. Same thing with Tommy Hughes, the Irishman who ran 2:27 at the age of 59. He actually went to the Olympics for Ireland in 1992. But then they stopped for a long time, which probably might have some benefits to extending their longevity. And then they started. And what the cross-sectional research has shown, so this is comparing over time, is that we get slower by 1 to 1.5% per year. So that's 10 to 15% every decade. What does that mean? That means that a marathon runner would go from a 3-hour marathon to a 3:20 over 10 years, 2 minutes a year, give or take. Okay. Ed Whitlock.
2 minutes a year over a marathon.
Over a marathon. It's about you can do the sum. So if you were a 40-minute 10K runner and you were losing 10% per decade, you'd be running 44, 45 minutes 10 years later.
Yeah? The reason why I don't want to question the science because I'm not one. I'm not a scientist. But that's quite an exact number given the fact that we're talking about all sorts of other factors. I mean, how do you measure that?
No, but that's the average number. Then you get Ed Whitlock comes along, who between the age of 48 and 70 deteriorated at about a third of that rate. So he just didn't slow down. So everyone else was on this one trajectory, and Ed Whitlock, nobody's staying flat. I mean, nobody's running the same at 70 that they were at 40, unless they didn't train at 40 and now they're training at 70. And we'll talk about how much you can get better even later in life compared to young. So what I've given you there is a typical decline would be between 1 and 1.5% per year. But there are some people who get a lot worse, a lot quicker, and there are many people who don't get worse at all. And then there are the exceptional athletes, the likes of Dykes and Whitlock and Hughes, who don't seem to. And that's why they're a source of such fascination for physiologists, is because what do these people have that makes them immune to the normal physiological effects of aging? It's quite remarkable. But to come back to your question is, I think this is what you were getting at, is every single person would benefit from exercise. So if you're listening to this at the age of 45, 50, or whatever it is, and you have doubts and you think that your best years are behind you and so on, well, my challenge to you would be to reframe that and say that there's potential for you to get considerably stronger and faster and fitter if you applied your mind and your body in the correct way now. So, for example, 2008 study by Henwood, they took 60-odd men, all of whom were living in these sort of older age communities. Average age of these guys was 71. Yeah. And within 6 months of training, they made them 50% stronger. That's enormous. That's a huge difference. Yeah. So even a 70-year-old person can become considerably stronger from doing fairly basic exercise training with weights. Same thing for runners. Is there have been studies that have shown that if there was one study that tracked people over about 20-odd years, and if they'd trained hard over 20 years, they hardly looked any different 20 years later. Yeah. If they trained intermittently or infrequently or not at all, then they look completely different. So there's so much you can do. And those muscle samples, scans that I showed you a few moments ago obviously might represent extreme cases of people who do extremely well with exercise. But everyone's got some benefit waiting for them if they do train.
Yeah, so I mean, as you just said, it's good news for those of us who, well, those of you who probably have never trained, because there is always potential to do something even later in life. And I think one of the most remarkable things, and I don't know whether you can answer this question, because it would be interesting to ask you anyway, is that obviously different sports affect aging in different ways. So if you were a runner, I'd imagine the degenerative effects of running could have a role to play in how fast you can run when you get older. But one of the things I often think is quite amazing, when I go out riding my bike, the amount of people in their late 60s, early 70s, who are riding exceptionally well. And there's a group here in Cape Town called the Recyclers, who have 74-year-olds who are going for sub-3 cycle tours, which here in South Africa, we have this annual event called the Cape Town Cycle Tour, which is 109 kilometers. Sub-3 is the 1% of that that finishing time. And there are guys in their 70s going for sub-3s. It seems almost that those guys are holding back the time that they're aging by, 20 years. That they're able to ride as well as anybody 20 years younger than them, and probably riding as well as they were when they were in their 40s and 50s. Is there a difference from what you know between the different sports, or is it just the fact that I know some good cyclists?
No, there'll definitely be some. And for sure, the type of exercise you do interacts heavily with the decline that you will experience. So even at a basic level, before I get onto the cycling versus running, is if you're again, and it's again constrained by the fact that it's cross-sectional, where you take a slice here and a slice there and a slice at X, Y, and a Z, and you compare them. Because what ideally you'd want to do is what I call the longitudinal, where you follow the same guy for 40, 50 years.
Yeah.
But cross-sectional analysis, for instance, of strength exercise or sports performance compares weightlifting to powerlifting. So weightlifting is quite a complex movement. If you imagine you're watching the Olympic Games weightlifting, whenever they happen, you're looking at like the clean and jerk, is the guy's got to get that weight off the floor, onto the shoulders, then up, got to straighten his legs. There's quite a lot of neuromuscular coordination and control and movement competency required for weightlifting. Whereas powerlifting, if it's a leg press or bench press, it's really a simpler movement. That makes sense, right?
Yeah, makes sense.
So what they found is that weightlifting performance declines faster with age than powerlifting because it's a complex task. And it involves more than just how well your muscles can produce force in one straight line. So the more complex the task, the more aging will affect it. So that's the first point, right? The other thing that's really interesting is that one of the things that happens in our muscles with aging is new muscles come from what are called satellite cells. So when we get muscle damage, our muscles regenerate. We get really stiff for 1 or 2 or 3 or 4 days, depending on how bad the training was. And then we actually produce new muscle that is more resistant to damage. And that's why we get stronger and more damage resistant. And that comes from these satellite cells. Some of the evidence shows that those satellite cells decline in number over life. They're almost like an inverse way. The rings on the rings in trees that count the age, the number of satellite cells also it goes the other way, right?
Right.
So it's possible that exercise that damages muscle, and running does that because it involves impact and eccentric contraction, is affected more by aging than something like cycling, which is actually a fairly smooth movement and is not affected by exercise. The other thing to remember is that the incidence of injury in running is much higher than in cycling. I mean, cycling, the injury you get is, unfortunately, oftentimes a car accident or a crash, and you get a scapula or a wrist or something that's broken in your eye. Whereas in running, there's chronic injuries. Like, how many runners have got knee, patellofemoral, ITB, Achilles tendon, plantar fascia, or something? I suspect that a lot of runners, by the time they're 60, just can't run anymore because they've had 7 fairly bad chronic injuries that they've never recovered from, whereas cyclists don't have that issue, so they can continue for a lot longer.
Yeah, so I suppose that does explain it. And you can also take a bigger load riding your bike than you can. You can go and spend 3 hours on a bike and with minimal impact, whereas a 3-hour run or a 2-hour run is obviously going to affect older athletes a bit more, I guess. I suppose the question is, what a lot of the runners say is that, having exercise as running, and we're digressing slightly here, but it's not to say that everybody should start riding their bikes because that's what's going to give them more longevity in their sport. There's lots of advantages of running because bone density is obviously a big issue amongst cyclists as they get older, particularly amongst women.
Right, which speaks a little bit to balance. But you made a really actually excellent point there on the fact that a three-hour cycle is a session from which the recovery is probably a day or two. A 3 to 4 hour run is a week long, if not more, recovery for someone who isn't recovering as well as they used to when they were younger. So that's a massive thing as well. So that if you set the ceiling at 26, 27 for how much training you can handle, a 70-year-old can handle much closer to that ceiling than a 70-year-old runner can relative to their 25-year-old self. So that's a massive issue as well. And then you're right, the argument about bone is saying, well, if exercise is doing these health things for us, then it helps to do holistic exercise that doesn't neglect one element of the health benefits we're going to get. This is a good opportunity to just debunk for a moment the whole running causes osteoarthritis thing, because I'm sure in your time as editor of Runner's World, you've seen that a few dozen times. does running cause knee pain and knee arthritis and so on? Pretty uniformly, studies that actually try and control for this find that it doesn't. And so the prevalence in people who run and those who do not is basically the same. The problem here is one of bias. It's that if you did run and if you've got 30 years of long distance running in your life, then your knee pain is easily attributed to 30 years of long distance running. So it looks like it caused it, but it actually doesn't go up in risk. So doing long distance running is if anything beneficial for the skeleton, but too much of it could be bad, I suppose.
Yeah, that is a bit. I agree with you. I get lots of questions about that, and everybody says, "Well, running's bad for your knees." And yeah, as you say, there's lots of research that suggests that's not true at all. Just move on to a slightly different angle on this: men versus women, who ages faster?
Yeah. So again, with the same boring old fine print that this is based mostly on cross-sectional studies, it appears that women deteriorate more with age than men do, which is interesting. But that also will be highly dependent on the sport. So in long distance running, that deterioration looks much more similar, for instance, than it does in a strength or power event. And that's probably because men, by virtue of testosterone and the increased muscle mass, have got a higher base to start from. And so even though they're losing it, the bit that remains is still functionally better than in women, where if you lost half of it, you're left with very little, if that makes sense, in terms of muscle mass and power. So women's weightlifting records drop off faster than men's. Women's powerlifting records drop off faster than men's do. And for sprint performance, it's a similar thing. Whereas in a marathon, you could probably say they're more or less comparable.
And then just to break it down a little bit. So when we talk about the changes in the body, obviously for men, one of the key factors is testosterone levels. When you were talking about women versus men there, I'm thinking, okay, do men have an advantage because they have more testosterone? And then how important is testosterone, first of all, for men? And how important is it for women because they don't have as much?
Yeah, so for men, the reduction in testosterone is one of the fundamental factors driving the aging decline, which is why, remember Sylvester Stallone?
What does testosterone do?
So testosterone, remember, is an anabolic steroid, which is androgenic. So the androgenic means male making, and the anabolic means building up. So anabolic means to build, whereas catabolic is to break down. So let's think about why athletes use testosterone as a drug, because testosterone is probably, or one of the relatives of testosterone, are probably the most common doping products used, especially for strength and power events. So what the athlete's doing there is that they're injecting this hormone into their bodies, and then they're training because they know that testosterone is going to switch on all the signals. It's going to amplify all the signals that are going to ultimately build muscle and allow them to increase power and strength and so forth and recover better. So whatever damage exercise is doing to the body is minimized by testosterone, along with growth hormone. So those are the two protagonists that can reverse whatever damaging effect exercise does. They also reverse whatever detrimental effect aging has on the body, which is why and this is decades ago now, probably, remember Sylvester Stallone got arrested going into, I think, Australia with a suitcase full of growth hormone and testosterone. That's anti-aging drugs. In fact, I've heard from people that in places like Hollywood, and certainly in London, this is the case also. I went on to Google before we spoke, and I looked up anti-aging clinic testosterone, and you can find these clinics that will give it to you as an anti-aging drug. So what a lot of older men are doing is they're going and saying, I'm a weaker, my libido is down, I'm not able to train, and the doctor says, here's the solution for you in a liquid vial. So that's what it's doing. And in the absence of that drug use,
is it legal to do that? I don't know.
Well, not if you're going to compete, right? And then there are doctors who question the ethics of it, but it's certainly legal for a doctor to give you a script for testosterone and or growth hormone if he believes that it's indicated because you, with age, have just got very little left. He can do that, yes. But
just asking for a friend.
Yeah, it's exactly like that. I've got this friend who, I suspect that it's one of those things that, like, it's not a toy of the wealthy, but you know what I mean? It's a pursuit of the wealthy, the sort of top 1%, who are basically saying, I'm not accepting that I'm a 65-year-old. I want to feel like a 35-year-old, and I'm going to ask my doctor down the street to help me out, you know, to do that.
Is it something that you would say you shouldn't do? I mean, what would the medical advice be on that? Is it dependent on what your levels are, whether it's dangerous or?
Yeah, it would depend, I think, on your levels. And if you had an honest and an ethical doctor who was quite risk averse, that doctor would hesitate very much to give testosterone to a 50-something-year-old unless that person's testosterone levels are very low, because now you're giving them a steroid hormone.
Yeah,
which is pretty powerful, and it's got all sorts of potential consequences in the body, as you know, if it's not used right. So when there will be cases, and I mean, who knows? Let's jump forward 30 years. Maybe I'm that guy who's going and saying, please, can I have a script for this stuff? Because I just, you know, otherwise I'm not getting out of bed in the morning. My body's so sore.
Yeah.
So I don't know. But The reason why I'm
asking that question is that people listening to this podcast will go like, okay, well, I'm 55, 60 years old, and Ross Tucker says, well, this is the anti-aging drugs. I'm going to my local doctor to find it out. But what you're saying is the doctor, an ethical doctor, will judge whether you are lower than you should be and whether it's having a health – there's a health risk if you don't go on it. I imagine it's a health-related subject rather than a performance one.
It should be. And the reason I brought up these anti-aging clinics and their willingness to dispense with testosterone so easily was more in condemnation of them. It's a sign of society and a sign of the times that people are trying to just take these drugs in order to undo the effects of time on their bodies. And I would be very cautious to do that unless you really did need it. You know, this is not... And by the way, you'll find doping incidents and cases of guys who want to win masters races, a 60-year-old cyclist who decides that he's going to beat guys younger than him. And how's he going to do that? Well, he's going to get a bit of testosterone and he's going to get a little bit of EPO, because all these hormones deteriorate or decline with age. And if you can then chemically replace them, then you're competing on an unequal playing field. So you're doping. But when it's for health reasons, of course, then it's different. But an ethical doctor needs to make that distinction, not us. So back to your question was, you were asking about the testosterone in men. So as that testosterone level goes down, men lose muscle mass. Our bone mass goes down. You know, like we reach peak muscle mass and bone mass, all things equal, in our late 20s, early 30s. And then as the testosterone level drops, we find it more and more difficult to keep that muscle mass on. So this hormone is one of the key things that underpins our decline in sporting performance ability, along with growth hormone, insulin-like growth factor, which affects our nervous system. And, you know, as I said, our older people literally have fewer nerves in their bodies. If you look at under a microscope, a cross-section of nerves, you see far fewer nerves in a 70-year-old than you would in a 25-year-old. So there's a lot of things going on under the control of hormones that affect us. Many of those are happening also in women. Some are happening only in women. Obviously, you get menopause in women at a later point. And then all of a sudden, estrogen levels and the hormone levels that control their metabolism are down to zero. And that causes in itself a whole set of changes. So there's a lot going on that differs between the sexes, yeah.
Yeah. So that's the bad news. The bad news that we can't hold back Father Time and Mother Time or whatever you want to be non-generic. But let's talk a little bit about what you can do. How can you slow? What is the most effective way to slow down this process, if you want to, without taking the vial?
Yeah, for sure. And again, the thing we can't emphasize enough is that exercise is anti-aging. You know, one day, like, my vision for the world would be that you could walk into an anti-aging clinic and there's a treadmill and a bicycle standing there, and you say, what's going on? And the doctor says, this, my friend, is how you stay young. Not in a needle injected or in a tablet, but actually exercising. And the thing about it is, and this is, some of you are listening to this as, you know, 25-year-olds who lucky you don't have this problem yet, like you and I, Mike. But the investments you make now persist for the next 60 years of your life, you know. So there are studies that have looked at people in their 70s, and the biggest predictor of their health and of their VO2 max and their performance at 70 is their history of training. So people who have a history of exercise throughout their lives, their VO2 max is 50% higher when they're 70 compared to people who don't exercise. Wow. That is
50%.
Yeah, 50%. So you're talking about, so someone who's in their mid to late 60s, for instance, might have a VO2 max, typically average would be 30, let's say, high 20s, right, low 30. Someone who's been physically active for all their lives, 40, 40 to 45. So that's, wow, a big difference that it makes. So the time you spend training now obviously needs to give you present rewards, enjoyment and health benefits and so on. But it's also actually giving you a lot of future rewards as well. So it's, yeah, it's definitely doubly beneficial. And then the other thing about that that I can't stress enough is, I remember going to a conference once where someone said, the single biggest predictor of quality of life and lifespan once you turn 70 is how fast you can walk, which is amazing. I was like, and I'll be honest, I've never verified this. It might be that he was embellishing the science a little bit. But he showed us some data, and your walking speed becomes the single best predictor of how many years you have left to live from the time you turn 70 on. And so that, what that means is the athleticism, because that's really what walking speed is. How athletic are you? I mean, we're not talking Usain Bolt charging down the track here. Yeah. We're talking about how fast can you walk across the parking lots, or when you, right, take the dog. South Africans, tomorrow morning when you get out there with your dogs for a walk, what's the maximum walking speed? That metric has got massive, massive value. It tells a lot about, yeah, the quality of life and your athleticism. And so how do you improve that? Is you train athleticism and you focus on that athleticism. So there's huge benefits to be gained. And I mean, I've told you of a study now that over 6 months, they improve strength by 51% in 70-odd-year-old men. Another one from 2008, I think it was Henwood did this one. Now, that might have been Henwood I was talking about before. Sorry, this was a 2020 study by someone called Blockyao. I forget this. I don't forget the surname. I just can't pronounce it. 36% gains in strength within 3 months of training. So 12 weeks, 36% stronger.
Wow.
So these gains that you think are exclusively available to young people are actually enormous, even in older people. So there is no reason why you shouldn't work at those. And just on that first study, they found that these people got 51% stronger. And then they tested them in a whole bunch of daily activities, like getting up from a chair, lying on the floor, and how long does it take you to get into a full standing position. Those things improve out of sight, because that strength and that stability that you get from training makes a massive difference. So you even if it's basic stuff like sitting down and getting up, that stuff is helping you. Now, obviously, we're talking about much later in life, but it's, yeah, beneficial. Yeah.
I mean, there's a couple of things I'm picking up as a theme in this podcast today. First of all, the benefits of being a lifelong active person. And second of all, that you definitely can benefit massively when you're older from doing some strength work. So when people talk about strength work versus endurance work, all those sort of things, they talk about as you get older and you want to perform better as a sports person, you include more strength work to keep your muscles stronger. Is, mm-hmm, that still the thinking?
Yes, it is. And the principle here is a very basic one. It's that if we were to characterize what gets worse with aging, we've said that the power and strength stuff gets worse than the endurance stuff. We know that what's happening is that your muscle mass is declining by, again, it's about 1 to 2% per year once you reach, say, 40, 45. And then your coordination is getting worse. So if I was to give you those three attributes, coordination or neuromuscular control, muscle mass, and then power and strength, the remedy to aging, so now we're saying what is anti-aging, is to focus on those three elements. Because if you can stop them from happening, you're not getting older. Right. Time might be going by, but you're not going with it. So right. For that reason, the training that you should be focusing on, not necessarily do all your stuff. I mean, like you're cycling a great deal and that's obviously very beneficial. But I know, for instance, that a few months ago you started to box. That's yes. Right. I don't know, I lost track of time.
I've been doing a lot of boxing in my garage over the lockdown period.
So that's a really good activity because it involves balance, involves coordination, it involves upper body and lower limb. It's fairly high intensity. That's an anti-aging exercise, no doubt. And one of the things older athletes don't need to worry about as much is the maintenance of endurance. You know, like if you've developed over your life endurance capacity, then going for a 2-hour bike ride is not that big a deal anymore for you.
Right.
But the thing that you're losing is power. So in the middle of that 2-hour bike ride, if you're going to encounter a 2-kilometer fairly steep hill, that's where you're going to see the effects of Father Time. Yeah. Therefore, that must be the thing that you focus on in training. So don't neglect the thing that you're going to be weaker in, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, because I think a lot of it's always tempting for people who are older to say, well, I don't want to do the high intensity stuff because if I do, exactly. My heart's going to explode and my pacemaker's going to give in. But ironically, there should be a slight shift towards that strength and power because that will keep you stronger and fitter for longer.
Correct. You must be careful. It's a classic risk versus reward thing.
It is.
The reward is huge. If you can do the higher intensity stuff, that's going to be the remedy. That's the medicine for the condition. You know, the condition is aging causing you to lose power and strength and high intensity cardiovascular capacity, VO2 max. The medicine is to do the training that focuses on that type of exercise. But that type of training comes with risks. So you've got to manage the dosage, right? If we use our medicine analogy. And the same thing, like we're talking cycling now, runners, it's even more the case. Because if I was to say to you that as a runner, you've got to go out and do some high intensity running intervals, now you are basically not sprinting, but the loading on your joints and on your muscles is enormous. And this is where injuries could happen. So be very careful about this. But you're right, it's the thing that we neglect easiest, and it's the one thing that we shouldn't be. It's a paradox. We neglect it because we're not good at it, but it's actually the very thing we should do. And just to reassure you, they've done studies in hospital settings where you take a person who is in congestive heart failure. This is the point of a failing heart, where your heart starts to fail and everything just backs up. These are medical emergencies. And there have been some remarkable studies where doctors and scientists have gone in and they've made those people exercise. Now, so this is a guy, by the way, whose VO2 max is like 11. He's barely got an oxygen capacity of someone sitting down. That's how affected they are. But they make them do interval work on a bicycle, and they actually get better. They actually adapt to it. But obviously in that setting, they're monitoring them. They've got them hooked up to all kinds of machines as an system, the cardio space. They have to be careful. But the point is that everyone can do interval training. And so The thing that I often try and encourage, even like my mom, you know, she walks the dog and it's an hour's easy walk. Every 10 minutes for 1 minute, walk fast as you can. Just that. You don't have to like find the steepest hill in the world and put a 20-kilogram backpack on there and sprint up it every second day. But for 1 minute or for 2 minutes, every 10 minutes, walk fast to the point that you're actually – by the end of that, you're breathing and you're saying, oh, gee, I'm glad I can stop now. That 2-minute period is doing you so much good that it shouldn't be neglected.
It's great advice. And I guess if you extrapolate down towards the different age groups, and me being 50 and then maybe, you know, people in their 60s, 70s, that intensity, you can do more of that as you go down towards the lower the age groups. And then somewhere around your 40s and 50s, you've got a nice balance of endurance and strength. So it's an understanding of what a role this plays. And that's another great takeaway from this pod is that, you know, people in their 70s understanding that just going for a walk around the block can be beneficial if it's done right.
Exactly. I mean, it's beneficial. Even if you just walk at a comfortable pace, you're with some friends and you talk and you catch up about the day or the week, even that's beneficial. I don't mean to make it sound like that's a waste of time. But if you can just find moments, you know, maybe your regular walk does have a hill. That's your moment. You know, it's a naturally designed interval session in your walk. There's a hill, go for it.
Yeah.
That stuff makes a big difference. And so I would highly encourage people to do that. And it's the same for a 40-year-old. I mean, I've met 40-year-old runners and consulted with them and met them to give them some training advice. And you look at their diaries and it's steady, 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 long. Steady, 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 steady. And that's cool because for 20 years, they've earned the ability to just tick over at a high level. You know, they're always at 70%. They're never at 50, but they're never at 90.
Yeah.
And the one tweak you can make is once a week, go to 90. Once a week, go to 80. And then in response, once a week, go to 50 and then do the rest of it at 70. So just play with it a little bit. You know, don't be so monotonous. That's a massive lesson. And that starts at the age of 30. You know, we're talking about 70-year-olds now. That starts at the age of 30.
So variety, I guess it's a training principle that it works pretty much for everybody, but variety becomes more important as we get to middle age and later on in life.
Yeah, exactly.
Makes it more interesting.
Correct. And it starts to challenge the things that lifestyle is not doing, you know? So again, we become less active over time. I've certainly noticed myself, I spend more time in a chair than I used to, especially during lockdown. My body is wrecked from lockdown. But that's why flexibility. So there's another example we haven't even touched on it, but like mobility, one of the things with aging is we lose flexibility. We can no longer stretch and it makes it difficult for us to pick things off the floor. And we are at risk if we are, let's say, older athletes of straining muscles. So maybe in your 30s, 40s is the time to start thinking about a yoga session once a week or some kind of functional mobility training, you know? So that variety, because if you think about you, the athlete, there are so many elements that make you up, you know, like little pieces of this puzzle, and aging is going to start to chip away at all those little pieces. You've got to combat that effect on them, and you do that with variety, yeah.
So I've got a bit of a fun challenge for you as we were talking now, and to give me an idea of where sports should be given up. And I think to myself, okay, well, what's the first sport that you would give up when you get older? And I'm thinking rugby. What's the last sport that you would give up? Maybe lawn bowls? Where does your continuum of sports that you should give up earlier and which are higher risk and which ones are less high risk as you get older? I'll give you a moment to think about that.
Contact sports right up there. You know, the problem with rugby, other than obviously like being tackled and the collisions, there's so many changes of direction. There's acceleration. There's stopping quickly. So like the incidence of muscle tears and muscle strains, for the same reason, football would be the same, you know. That's not to say you shouldn't do it. I mean, I've seen, even in a park nearby where I live, there are a bunch of guys who play, and you see some guys who look distinctly out of place because they're in their sort of 50s and so on playing football with these youngsters. And it keeps them young. I think it's terrific.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing you should do. But there will come a point when more hazardous than it's worth. You know, then you've got to maybe let go. So what would be the best ones? Anything that's low on impact, you know, because with time, our tendons, our collagen, our joints start to become less able to handle that force and loading. So cycling is a good one. Provided you're not affected in terms of like lower back, you know, how many cyclists do you know in their 50s, 60s who just can't do long rides because of back issues?
Yeah.
There's many. Cycling would be one. The problem with only cycling is that it's pretty one-dimensional. For that reason, you would want to do something else. table tennis, for instance, for coordination, for lateral movement, for side movement. You're not in any danger of rupturing an Achilles or anything unless you slip off and fall. But that would be an example.
I'd also recommend boxing, but not as in fighting another person, but more training boxing. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, the movement, the balance, the ability, like just that proprioceptive awareness that you're getting from swimming, connecting your upper body to your lower body, being able to, that's a massively functional task that I think people would benefit from as well. Yeah. So walking and cycling for your heart, table tennis for your coordination, and boxing for strength. And then, I remember being in Japan last year for the World Cup, and when I was in Beijing, 5 or 6 years ago, and all the parks are full of people doing Tai Chi and these slow, controlled movements, you know? That type of stuff is very valuable also, because it's teaching you, again, that body awareness and breathing. And so that's another thing you can do, like, right the way through, I reckon. So definitely all of those, you know? But ultimately do what you love most, you know?
Yeah. And I think your point is taken that, you know, sports like soccer, yes, rugby might be a bit of a push when you're in your 50s, especially if you're playing contact rugby, but soccer, you know, you're playing with your kids and playing with your friends, there's certainly ways of getting around the injury factor. But doing what you love, whether it's cycling, running, and being active is probably the major lesson here, because even if it is risky, if you're being active, it's less risky than being non-active.
Right, and then... So those are all the ingredients, you know, you're cooking now, and those are all the ingredients on the countertop. Really, the only thing you now have to think about more is how do I put all that stuff together, you know? That's maybe the key thing. And if there was some advice I could give people there, I just want to find some slides for you because I think these will be valuable. So I'm going to share my screen with you again. Those of you watching on the podcast, obviously, I'll do my best to explain this at the same time as I talk through, as show it. But Imagine a month of training, right? So you've got a month, it's May. When you're a young athlete, 3 out of those 4 weeks can be hard weeks because you have the capacity to recover. So you can go hard, 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 and then the 4th week is a recovery week. And then June comes and it's hard, 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 recover, hard, 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 recovery. So it's 3 weeks on, 1 week off. That's a classic principle most people are aware of. I'm sure you've heard of that, right?
Yeah.
So that's the first element is your, let's call it your sort of meso cycle of training. It's hard, 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 easy. Then the other thing you can do within each week is you can have easy day, hard day, easy day, hard day, easy day, hard day. So your hard days might be interval sessions. It might be a club time trial. It might be a long run. It might be a race that you enter on the weekend to test yourself, that kind of thing. And so... So how you put your week together is also different. And what a young athlete can afford to do is do 2 hard days on a Monday and a Tuesday, then a rest day or a week or an easy day, and then go hard again on a Thursday and then a rest day and hard again on a Saturday. So when you are younger, you can have 3 high-quality days per week, whereas when you're older, you need to think a little bit more to give 2 hard days because you need more rest days. But the one thing you never compromise on is the hardness of the hard day. So what if you're watching this on YouTube now, what you're basically looking at is a training log for a person over the course of, in this instance, 57 days. So it's an 8-week cycle. And you'll basically see that a typical would be 3 weeks hard, 1 week easy, 3 weeks hard, 1 week easy. And then within each week, there'll be 3 hard sessions. With rest days in between them. So you'll go hard, easy, hard, easy, hard, easy. What an older athlete needs to do is go 2 weeks hard, 1 week easy, 2 weeks hard, 1 week easy. So your global picture changes so that you do more recovery weeks per year than you normally would have done, right? So that's number one. Number two, within each week, you train hard twice a week, not 3 times a week, because that way you can have 2 days off after each hard session, minimum. So you go hard, easy, easy, hard, easy, easy, hard, that kind of thing. Quality day every second or third day. Or sorry, every third or fourth day instead of every second. But the thing that you absolutely do not compromise on is that your hard days must be hard.
Yeah.
So in other words, when you do a quality session, that's the one thing an older athlete doesn't have to scale back on compared to a younger athlete. So the key principles are change the frequency and change the volume of the hard quality sessions but don't change the intensity. Intensity is the thing that you must try and keep constant.
There you go. Well, Professor Ostucker, it's been fascinating as usual. I think I'm going to take a bit of advice when I get out of my first post-lockdown ride tomorrow and go and do a couple of hill sessions to loosen up the lungs and the legs tomorrow. But just as we look forward to the rest of the year, obviously just some final comments. We've seen a couple of developments happening around the world of sport, obviously since we spoke about Corona. We know the Olympics has been cancelled. You said in the last podcast it looked unlikely that it might happen even in 2021. Just a final word on that. It looks like your prediction that it might not happen next year has been confirmed by officials in Tokyo, that it might not happen because there's no guarantee that the world will be safe properly by then.
Yeah, at this stage, I think people have recognized that it's vaccine or bust in terms of the Olympics. You know? Like, the one thing I'll say, having watched this Corona stuff unfold now, is the pace of scientific knowledge development is astonishing. I mean, it's extraordinary. You mentioned before we came on air about the vaccine that's now being trialed out of Oxford. I saw a stat the other day that vaccine has gone from development to human trial within 60 odd days. And the previous record was about 3.5 months. Yeah. So every record, every time frame that we thought possible for how these things could happen has been changed, because never before have so many people thrown their intellects into one question. So I don't know. I mean, we're only in May, basically, tomorrow. So in the next 3 months, knowledge could go 5 times faster than it has done in the past. And it's possible we either get a vaccine, or not necessarily a vaccine, but a way that we can treat this virus and cure it or stop it from spreading or something in another way, you know. So that's what gives me some hope still. But yeah, I saw that the guy said that if it can't happen in 2021, then it's not going to happen. And most sports, I think, are saying that until there's a vaccine, normal sport won't continue. So what everyone's trying to figure out now is how do we get to sport without crowds? Because that's really the problem. And so I read that the Spanish football planned on testing their players twice a week. And if their players were negative, they'd play. And so they're trying to get back there in empty stadiums, obviously. But that's kind of their solution. And people want to get back to normal, but we're still, you know, it's horrible because I feel so tired from it. Yeah. But I keep having to remind myself that we're actually still in the quite early stages of it.
Yeah. I suppose the reason why I asked that question is because I want to be able to look back on these podcasts that we do over this time and talk about, you know, some of the themes, because it's almost like noting down some of the history, because perhaps when we look at these podcasts in a year's time or 2 years' time, we'll be able to say, wow, we had no idea, or we were spot on. And I think that's probably why I asked you the questions, because it changes literally every week.
Yeah, it feels like if you make predictions, it's folly, you know. Even some of the rugby I was doing is I was tracking countries that play rugby to look when they might have reached peak. So in other words, number of cases and number of deaths, and when does it look like it turns back down? Because once it turns back down, you think, okay, we can be optimistic about this. Yeah. And I'm not even exaggerating. In about 4 or 5 countries, we hit peak and it turned down. And then a few days later, hit a new peak, and then it turned down. So no one even knows whether we're at peak at this stage. And it's anyone who makes predictions, and they're starting to come out on Twitter now, by the way, tweets from like 3-4 weeks ago or 2 months ago saying, this will all be gone by April, or America won't even get to 60,000 deaths by August. They hit it yesterday.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think for sure, if you make a prediction, you're a bit of a fool at this point. I will tell you what. I don't know about you, though. Have you watched virtual cycling on TV?
I have, but unfortunately, I find it deadly dull. It's not anywhere close to the real thing, sadly.
So bang average. I caught some the other day. It was like some tour of Switzerland or something. Yeah. And I was like, you have to be kidding me. This is dire.
No, it's terrible.
Yeah. If you've got to look forward to for the rest of the year, I mean, oh my goodness.
I'm so glad that here in South Africa, they're showing old cycling tours the Vuelta's on at the moment, and every single night I tape one of the stages and watch it when I can. It gives me a chance of normality, I guess, in the madness that we experience at the moment. So it gives us a chance. Yeah. I certainly agree with you. Virtual cycling is literally nothing close to the real thing. I can't watch it. But
no, I'm the same. I cannot. I haven't watched much sport in the last while. I'm seriously accepting that, you know. But yeah. I happened to catch the other day, they're showing UFC, you know, on Supersport.
Yeah, and I love that.
Because, you know, the one thing about that is I've got no idea what happened.
Yeah.
It's so foreign to me that I'm watching it might as well be live because it's got no meaning for me. Whereas when I'm watching rugby or football or cricket, like even if I don't know exactly what's about to happen in the next minute or two, I kind of know, oh, that's the team that won and this is the team that and so it doesn't have value, but I hope they figure out how to
do it. So there's a tip for our listeners. If you want to enjoy some sport, watch a sport you've never watched before and not watch the highlights from the last 5 years because it'll be like watching it live. So try and watch a new sport during this time. Could be a good bit of advice.
Exactly.
Don't forget, you can engage with us on our Twitter feed, which is Science of Sport Podcast. Of course, Ross is Science of Sport, Mike Finch, SA. And we also have a Patreon page. And we ask you to come and have a look at our Patreon page. It will be on our links and our notes in our podcast. It gives you a chance to help us keep this podcast going. And if you can make a small donation every single month, we would really appreciate it. At the moment, we're doing it for the love mostly, and we would like to continue and potentially do some more stuff around these podcasts going forward, but we would need your help to assist us a little bit in making sure that happens. So have a look at our Patreon link. It'll be on the podcast page, and feel free to make a small donation or a monthly donation. That's our only plug. That's the only plug we're going to put out today.
Sorry, I was going to tell you that we've actually got, since I launched it, we've got 7 Patreons, and I thought we might just say thanks to them.
Let's do that.
So I sent a tweet out. I mean, and also I hate asking for money in a way, you know, which is what it feels like. But as Mike says, we do this because we love doing it and we're not going to stop doing it. But if you do enjoy spending an hour every couple of weeks with us and you feel like giving us a pledge, then hop over onto Patreon and join us. I set it up sort of tongue in cheek with different levels where you can join as either an Olympic athlete or an Olympic champion or an Olympic legend. And so far, we've got a bunch of Olympic athletes here. So, for instance, we've got Simon has joined us. He pledged a little bit more than he needed to, so thanks very much. We're very honored. Liam Grest came in and pledged more than he needed to also at that level. Another Liam Fergus, James Jackson, Harry Black, Diego Puga, and then Graham Smith. Not that Graham Smith, I checked. There's a Graham Smith. So those are our 7 first members, the elite, the magnificent 7. And yeah, like if you, as Mike and I just said, if you feel like throwing in a little bit of weight and staging behind the pod to keep us going, we would be most grateful for your company. Thanks.
Yeah, so thanks very much, Ross. And we'll be speaking to you soon. We've got a next podcast coming up in a couple of weeks' time. But we ask all of our and hope all of our podcast listeners are doing well and healthy and surviving this time. And we look forward to bringing you some fun podcasts. We probably won't focus too much on the corona thing over the next couple of months because there's going to be way too much about that. We're going to focus on some of the cool stuff around sports science. Professor Ross Tucker, thank you very much for your time again.
Follow the Science of Sport podcast at Sports SciPod and on Instagram at Science of Sport Podcast.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.